May the 10th, it's only around the corner after a long, cold and lonely winter. Here comes the sun. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I'm visiting my father, who's in the nursing home for the last 4 years, fully complimentous, 100 years old, and we had to celebrate his birthday by Zoom. So we're all looking forward to being able to meet as a group.
If love and support and encouragement could cure Paddy, he'd be Superman at this stage.
I am taken aback to think that this is a discretion that my school has taken. To be honest, it's quite disappointing. You know, the students deserve to get as much education as they can before they finish in June.
The 10th of May. We're not there yet and we'll still have to watch ourselves, but things will look a bit more normal during May. That's what we're looking forward to. Political correspondent Micheál Lehane was talking to Mary Wilson in the morning.
May 10th becomes the big date next month on when things look set now to change. And it's at that point that people will be able to travel across the country. The ban on inter-county travel is lifted. And also things like personal services and hairdressers, they can open again for appointments. Non-essential retail, and from a click and collect point of view, and outdoor retail on that date, that returns as well. But some of the big changes then centre around people's ability to meet up outdoors and in limited cases indoors. The outdoor meetings move from 2 to 3 households, and that can happen now in private gardens. That's a big change there. And then there is a proposal that would allow a vaccinated household meet an unvaccinated one, and that seems to have a particular relevance for grandparents and their ability to meet their extended families. And then the people who have been fully vaccinated, and that does mean different things. There are different definitions of that depending on what vaccination was received. But 3 vaccinated households can meet indoors from that point. Also things like training for sports teams in pods of 15, that can resume on that date as well. There is one interesting proposal in there which hasn't been fleshed out yet and we could see more of today, and that is that outdoor events of up to 15 people should be allowed in May as well from that date. That's likely to be a reference, one feels, to arts activities, but it hasn't been clarified in detail yet.
So Micheál, May 10 is the first key date and the big reopening starting with inter-county travel, as you say. We move on then, though, to May 17, when it's anticipated, isn't it, that shops would reopen again?
Yeah, that's the date when all non-essential retail shops can fully reopen, and it follows on 7 days from when you see the beginning of that phase reopening with the click and collect service and outdoor retail. So again, another key date in the month of May and something that has been anticipated by many.
Now, what about hospitality? Let's talk through the hospitality sector, and they have to wait a little bit longer.
They do, and this is something that was debated at length yesterday, and up until even late last night, there were mixed views and mixed opinions as to what would happen there. Could outdoor hospitality, after all, return in May? And many in government felt that that was possible. Ultimately, that hasn't been the case. What you have is changes, though, to how outdoor hospitality is viewed, and changes too inevitably will follow in the regulations. And I suppose the big one there is that all pubs now will be treated the same. There is no distinction between those so-called wet pubs and gastro pubs. So from June the 7th, outdoor hospitality can resume. That's after the bank holiday weekend. And that includes restaurants and all pubs being able to serve outdoors. Before that, however, there is a big change on the hospitality front, but it's in relation to hotels and guest houses. They will be able to open in advance of that June bank holiday weekend now. And June 2nd has been set as the reopening date for that sector.
But is there any is there anything being allowed for any indoor dining or indoor pubs? Is everything contingent on pubs being able to have outdoor space?
Yeah, the wider indoor dining is something that seems to be a matter for later in the summer, most likely July. I suppose it will be slightly different for the residents, it would seem, who are staying in hotels. That would seem inevitable, but it's again something that the government are going to have to provide clarity on today. But the proposal, and based on that view that outdoor is okay when it comes to hospitality in general, it is outdoor only for the month of June, it seems.
And this goes to Cabinet later today. We're expecting announcements from the three leaders then further on into the afternoon or evening. But is this a plan that has buy-in from the health chiefs, from NPHET, and from the politicians?
I think it does. I heard Eamon Ryan's comments there, and you can see, despite everything, and there was no doubt about it, there was a wave of optimism swirled around government buildings yesterday evening in the lead up to that meeting and indeed from many afterwards. But there still will be a degree of caution in the sense that this is happening on a phase basis and it will be subject to ongoing review again all the time. But I suppose it is based on the fact that more people are getting the vaccine all the time.
Micheál Lehane on Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson. Then later, Ryan couldn't contain his excitement.
We have places to go now. We have hairdressers to visit. We have churches to attend. We have gyms to work out in. We have outdoor pubs. Yes! Welcome! Give me a flat manky Guinness in a bar with flies. I don't give a damn. I'm thirsty now. Hotels will be opening. B&Bs will be opening. Weddings will be bigger. Matches will be back. It's just going to get better and better every day. So enjoy the good news while it lasts, because it's all coming down the tracks. Some of the tabloids are getting on. The Irish Daily Mail headline is, "Here comes our summer." That'll do nicely. The Irish Daily Mirror in second place with "Sip Snip Hooray." But the prize today for best headline on the subject is the Irish Daily Star with "Going, Going, Goujon." Because the Goujon 9 euro farrago is over. If you're going to a wet pub, get your pints in and you can have a packet of peanuts if you want for 2 euro or 1 euro. You don't have to go to the old 9 euro. I mean, we will be laughing in years to come at the stories about the empty pizza boxes that were spread about different bars outside. Did you have the pizza? Yes, I did. I assure you, I had 16 of them. That's why I have all these boxes beside me. I'm quite frankly well able to walk home unaccompanied. And that's all going to happen. Beer gardens and outdoor dining in June, May the 10th for haircuts. Hallelujah.
And the Ryan Tuberty Show. And then Claire Byrne was talking to some businesses about the planned reopening.
I'm joined now by Daniel Smith of Grogan's Castle Lounge on South William Street, closed since the 14th of March 2020. Daniel, I'm sure the news of a reopening date was welcome. I know you were tweeting last night that there won't be a cow milked in South William Street tonight. Are you relieved?
Morning, Claire.
Morning.
Yeah, very relieved. I mean, it's been a long, by the time we reopen, we'll be just a week short of 15 months closed. So to finally have a date in sight, and it looks as though it will go ahead. It's like overwhelmingly positive. Obviously, it's not perfect. As you mentioned, the issue with the hotels being allowed to serve indoor before we're allowed to serve outdoors. Not ideal, but look, we've got light at the end of the tunnel. We've got a date set. We can work toward it now. And we're delighted to have that.
So your date now is the 7th of June. And from that date, you'll be allowed to serve people outside.
Yeah. So we're quite lucky. We've obviously got the street corner there, and we've actually got quite a lot of space to work with there. So we'll be able to fit in enough customers safely that it's a viable way to open your business.
And have you had assurances from Dublin City Council about how much outdoor furniture you'll be allowed to have there now?
Well, no, we've a licence anyway for outdoor furniture, so we would assume that stands as usual.
Mm-hmm. Would you not need to expand that, given that you won't have anyone inside?
We'll look at ways of doing it. Obviously, we need to do it safely, and we need to figure out the dimensions basically and figure out what sort of capacity we can fit in our area. So that's something that has to be done now. Once the date's confirmed, we have to work toward that over the next few weeks.
I'm sure this was more than you expected. Am I right? I know you were following all of the news last night as it happened.
I mean, look, the track record with these things for the past 12 months or so hasn't been great for our industry. So it was very hard, like I was trying my best not to get excited, but the excitement was kind of taken over, you know, like we've been led up the hill and kicked back down it before, but Yeah, I mean, look, it's overwhelmingly positive in comparison with what we've faced over the last 12 months.
Then Restaurant Association's John Healy also spoke to Clare.
I mean, it's great news, of course, but like, I just feel like that this announcement is kind of like a shot in the foot for all of us, because I don't understand why hotels are allowed to open almost a week before restaurants can get outdoor dining. And outdoor dining only serves 20% of the restaurants in this country. Most restaurants are in the middle of town or on a street that they can't do any outdoor, and they haven't got the facilities for outdoor. As well as that, a lot of the high-end restaurants can't open now at all because they just don't have outdoor dining. It's just not feasible. There's a lot of clarity that needs around the whole thing as well. The wedding, for example, that doesn't work. It really doesn't work. And I've got 60 brides until the end of the year waiting sort of patiently, and have been for the last 6 months, to see what's going to happen with weddings, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of clarity needs to happen, and a lot of, you know, what's going to happen. I have outdoor space for 40 in Susie Street, and we're one of the very lucky restaurants that built an outdoor area a couple of years ago. But I was only allowed 15 people per sitting the last time. So that clarity of numbers needs to come out as well.
And do you have clarity now as to what that will be on the 7th of June?
Nothing. No. For example, they said outdoor dining will reopen the 7th of June, and that's it. That's the only statement I've read.
Can I just bring Philip Ryan back in on this? Philip, yeah. Do you know, is there going to be a limit on the number of people who can be in a restaurant sitting outside?
I think there's a determination to change that. Leo Radker brought it up at his parliamentary party last night that they do away with the 15-person limit and maybe focus it more on the size of your restaurant and the square footage and how many people a premises can fit safely, rather than focusing on, because you've had instances in last year where there was huge restaurants with loads of space that could only technically have 15 people in it. So I think there's a determination to change that.
Yeah. And as well as that, table sizes and all that kind of stuff needs to be ironed out as well, so we can reopen our reservation system.
And then looking past the 7th, when you'll be open and the hotels will be open, it would seem from what Philip has said that they'll be allowed to have people inside, but you won't.
Yeah, unfair. Totally unfair. But I know what's happening here is that they're going to keep us. I mean, this is not a level 4 lockdown. We're still in level 5 as far as I'm concerned. And in June, we'll get a little breadcrumb from the table that you get outdoor dining. And then you have to wait until the vaccination program ramps up and gets to like a certain percentage of the population being vaccinated, so that it's safer to open the system again.
And what about saying goodbye to all those dodgy DIY haircuts? Danielle Kennedy, Irish Hairdressers Federation President, also spoke to Clare.
Today there's a real positive shift. The 4th, was a little bit good last night when we started hearing it, but the 10th, it had been kind of thrown out the middle of May the last couple of weeks, so it's looking like we could be one of the first industries reopen in this round of easing of restrictions, and we're excited to see that. Like, we've spent the last year saying what a controlled environment salons are, and it looks like that's been taken into account. And it just shows, I suppose, salons, they're not only a local, a vital part of local economies, they're very much embedded in local communities as well. And we're just delighted that it looks like we're going to get back open, get back to looking after our clients again. It's going to be a busy few days, I think, but it's exciting. It's a positive day.
And there's going to be a rule, isn't there, a new rule that you won't be able to take walk-ins. Now, I'd imagine for a lot of salons that walk-ins don't happen, but barbers, you always see a queue outside the barbers, don't you, on a Saturday afternoon?
Yeah, well, actually, I own a walk-in salon. My water salon was predominantly walk-in. It's a 40-station salon, and last year we had to adapt and change to appointments. But I think that just proves that, we've had that walk-in salon for 10 years. It's got a very large staff, has a lot of clients in it, and it just shows how adaptable the industry is. Like, we were able to just change from walk-in to appointments overnight. We're a very adaptable industry, and we've kind of shown throughout the whole pandemic how easily we can adapt and change. Mm-hmm.
I saw a couple of people last night worried that if it was going to be the 4th that they wouldn't be ready to open next week. Does the 10th give your members enough time to get the stock in, organise their own lives, childcare, etc., get the staff back into work?
Yeah, look, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a busy week to try and get everything done. I suppose in terms of stock, the big issue kind of had been that most salons operate on a 30-day credit term, so people didn't want to order stock in April that they'd have to pay for at the end of April when they may not open until the end of May or beyond. So look, there's going to be probably a big rush today for everyone getting their orders in. But look, we're confident everyone will get it all done in time. We've done it before. We can do it again.
Well, that's Danielle Kennedy of the Irish Hairdressing Federation on Today with Claire Byrne. Then later on the News at One, Sinead Crowley was chatting about the reopening to people on Dunleary Pier.
I think everybody is starting to kind of see the rollout of the vaccines, and there's an expectation there that things will ease with more people vaccinated. So I'm quite optimistic about it.
What do you think is the first thing you'll do?
Well, I've got a couple of important birthdays coming up. My father is turning 80 and my wife has a big birthday. I won't mention which one. So you know, having some sort of celebration with them, I think will be the first thing. And then seeing my sisters when they can eventually travel back from abroad. They both live abroad, so that's been a major thing. They haven't been able to see our baby, of course, the last year.
We're retired, it's not quite so bad. We can go out at a time that suits us and we're not on the clock, so it's not. But for people who are working, it must be dreadful. So we're happy that the restrictions are lifting, because we can do some more, not necessarily take off on holidays or anything, but with a little bit more leeway to visit family who do not live in Dublin or do not live within 5 or 10 or 20 kilometres. And visiting my father, who's in the nursing home for the last 4 years, fully complimentous, 100 years old, and we had to celebrate his birthday by Zoom. So we're all looking forward to being able to meet as a group rather than one-to-one.
The other thing is that the entertainment and theatre and arts get back on track. For all of those people, it has been very, very tough. So for all the people in theatre, actors, singers, technicians, makeup people, the whole lot, they all need something. And it's, you could say it's unfair, but unfortunately that's the way it has happened.
Were you expecting it?
I was hopeful. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So was it a nice boost to hear the news this
You morning? Know, seriously, I think it was. In fact, I walked a little farther today, probably in the spirit of it. So I think we're all just ready to have that sense of normalcy back. So, and the sun certainly helps too. So it's a good combo. What's the first thing I'll do? I'll probably just do a bit more of this and feel a little bit more easygoing about it.
From the News at One. And on Morning Ireland, Anya Lawler was marking Poetry Day Ireland, talking to young poet Sasha Terfus.
I feel as though poetry has always had some sort of impact, especially because, you know, it's an art form that has managed to survive this long. But I think in the last year, it's definitely been a form of comfort to not only creatives and writers and poets themselves, but to also audiences and people going throughout their lives. I can't even sum up how many times I've seen family members and friends who may not be in this industry or may not be within this community, you know, posting little snippets of poems or even writing their own poetry as a way to kind of deal with everything that's happening outside their front door.
Now, you're going to be busy tonight. Tell me about Mod Words, what it is and what you're doing.
So there's a couple of things actually going on today. One of them will be part of the Mod Words community down in Waterford. So we have quite a close-knit kind of arts community down here. Everyone is welcome and everyone kind of supports each other. And as part of that, what's happening at 8 p.m. at Waterford In Your Pocket is there's going to be almost like a video project that's going to go live. And on this video project, we're actually going to be celebrating 100 years of poetry. So from the 20s up until the 20s, I'm also in it. It's one of the only events that I'm actually doing this year, because I'm delighted to say I finally get to experience Poetry Day rather than just performing in it. And I'll be performing a piece of my own poetry and a piece of poetry from Mary Devonport O'Neill, which was a Waterford writer back in the 20s. So that will be on Waterford In Your Pocket on YouTube and Facebook at 8 p.m. And I think it'll be really an interesting glimpse at Irish poetry.
You have a fantastic piece, Race and Identity, that people can find online. You perform it there. But you've a poem for us before you go, Sasha. You're going to read for us now, The Boy and the Stars.
So this is an excerpt from that poem. When we teach our boys to be men, we must tell them of the stars, how they lay themselves for the dark and let it strip them bare, of how they disappear at dawn's break, leaving nothing but the shadow of a decade. Yet every evening at dusk, they make a date with the moon and fall head over heels for the night all over again. As they stretch tall and begin to broaden, they should know that the earth is bigger and wider than they ever could be. They are small and fragile. And that is okay. That is what it means to be human, lost amongst the galaxies, a pale blue dot, inconspicuous amongst the other pale blue dots. We are a congregation of skies, of stars, of universes, just gathering for the sake of gathering, laughing for the art of laughing.
Lovely. That's Sasha Terfuse from Morning Ireland with Anya Lawler. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, one of those interviews that remind you that life is fragile and precious and things can change dramatically in such a short time. So Ryan was talking to Diane Collins about her family and her work for a charity called Behind the Mask. But first, Diane spoke about always wanting to become a Garda.
When I was going to Santa all those years ago, my number one mission when I went in was to get the blue bag. Because I wanted the handcuffs and the sheriff's badge and the gun. And that was my biggest fear as I queued up to wait to see the man in the big red suit. No, it just comes down to it was the fact that I always wanted to be a guard and always wanted to be a member of an Garda Síochána. So it roots from there, from when I was a very young age.
That is and was that from watching stuff or reading stuff?
I was a big fan of Dick Tracy comics.
Get away.
I was a big fan of Dick Tracy comics and seeing him on TV, and it just stemmed from there, and then it escalated then to fingerprinting kits and, yeah.
Love all that. That's great fun. There used to be a book publisher called Osborne, and they used to do like the Osborne Guide to Spying or Detective Work, and you could put talcum powder in an afternoon tea tin and hope that somebody was standing in it so you get their footprint. Were you doing that sort of silliness?
Oh, I had my younger brother and my older sisters absolutely played. I mean, it was a hub of investigation in my bedroom. I was constantly on the job trying to sort something or track something down or help someone. So, yeah.
Isn't that amazing? And your folks were kind of half in two minds about the wisdom of this. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no history of an Garda Síochána in our family, so to say. I went to college first, and then once I had, they thought that I might get it out of my system, but no, it was always the plan. So as soon as I finished my exams in the May, I went into Templemore that August. So that was August 2005. Yeah, and I've been very happy ever since as a member of an Garda Síochána, and I'm stationed in Killarney in County Kerry.
And you met somebody rather interesting in Killarney and County Kerry in the station, is that right?
I did. I met my husband, Paddy Tuig. The very first day Ryan I went on the beat, it was October 2006. Very first day I met him, went on the beat, and the rest is history, really.
Were you distracted from your Garda duties by this man?
No. Absolutely not.
Come on,
right,
Diane. You just said it was love at first sight. You went on the beach. You were just short of holding hands. Come on.
No, we were never holding hands. We got a very stern warning in that respect. You'd never think we were together really in the station. I mean, we don't really acknowledge each other at work in that sense, I suppose, and that's out of respect for our colleagues and for the people that we were working.
No, I get that. But in the early days, at that first night on the beat, you clearly knew there was something in the air.
Yeah, I mean, that's eventually where he brought me back and proposed in 2017, a long time later, but a fun time later.
Wow.
And, yeah.
And children?
Yeah, we have a 22-month-old little girl, Tara Grace, and we have another little person on the way the end of July.
Oh, congratulations. That's
beautiful. We have a busy little house.
And Ryan asked Diane about getting involved with the charity Behind the Mask.
Yeah, I'm a community guard in Killarney, and I work with a number of different organisations and charities. And one of the ones I got involved in was Behind the Mask. And it's the powerhouse behind this project is Mary Carlo Sullivan of the Little Memory Gallery. She's a freelance photographer based in Killarney Town. So Over the last year, Mary has been taking photographs and sharing stories of people of Killarney and, you know, the different efforts and struggles over COVID. And behind the mask is her project. I mean, I'm only helping in this. And it's, I suppose, Killarney's version of the Humans of New York.
Oh, brilliant.
So it's a real cross-section of society. And it culminates then with the frontline workers who were based in University Hospital Tralee. And it's just a snapshot of the last 12 months.
And Pieta House and the Irish Cancer Society will be among those benefiting from sales for this.
That's correct.
Book.
Yeah, it's for the proceeds of the book will go towards those charities, and I suppose that's why I'm on talking to you about that today. We initially were amazed by the power of social media with regard to this book. Mari had shared a post on Facebook. My sister-in-law spotted it, contacted Mary directly. She's a graphic designer, Sinead Collins. She's based in County Clare. Mm-hmm. So there's the three of us involved in this project now, and we're just trying to get support for the book and get, I mean, ideally, if we could get a publisher, that would be the goal. And then all the money raised for the book then would go to the charities that are involved and for the frontline workers, which myself and Paddy both are as well. So, you know, we've a couple of different interests in respect of the book.
Little did you know when you got involved in the project that you would become very connected to one of the charities to benefit from them. So talk to me about Paddy and how is he?
So myself and Paddy, as a family, we've had a very difficult 4 weeks. Just to give you a bit of a background, Paddy, he's a very, very fit, active man. He would have been pretty much at all the COVID checkpoints based in around the Killarney area over the last year. He's very well known in Killarney town, very well liked. And up until six, seven weeks ago, he was out running, Ryan. He was training. He's very active. He's always played football. But unfortunately, in the last 4 weeks, he has been diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma that has spread throughout his body. So we've gone from being one of the supporters, the raisers for the charity, to potentially becoming one of the beneficiaries. Our lives have been turned upside down, inside out, in the last 4 weeks. And we find ourselves on a very unknown road ahead. Very scary. He's in hospital now 5 weeks. He's gone through his second round of immunotherapy. He's under a fantastic doctor, Dr. Derek Power. And cancer, you know, has never really touched our lives before, thankfully. But wow, in the last 4 weeks, it's really hit us with a bang.
And Diane contacted Ryan about the sudden change for her young family.
You wrote a lovely note to me and you said, I feel like I'm living in a Nicholas Sparks novel.
Yeah, that's the only way I could describe it.
Tell me about that.
So, you know, we have a fantastic life. I mean, we have wonderful careers in Killarney. You know, it's been picture perfect. Now, by no means am I putting us on a pedestal or, you know, we're not perfect, but the last 4 weeks, I do feel like a main character in a Nicholas Sparks novel. It's been heartbreaking. We're shell-shocked. You know, we're absolutely petrified of what we're facing. And it's important to acknowledge these feelings.
How old is Paddy?
Paddy was turned 44 on Monday.
Was he ever a drinker or smoker? Or
never.
Nothing?
No, he's never drank. He's never smoked. Now, I would describe him as a social butterfly, Ryan. If there were 8 nights in the week, Paddy would go out nights in the week. From the perspective of Killarney Town, because it's such a sociable area.
And
you would describe him as the drunkest non-drinker at a wedding. He'd be dancing all night long.
Okay. It's a great description.
He's never drank, he's never smoked. So this is completely out of the blue for us.
I like the way you describe yourself as a blender. I hadn't heard that before as an expression. Tell me about that.
Paddy's a social butterfly. I'm the blender. I don't like to be the centre of attention.
Okay.
And I find myself very much so the centre of attention at the moment. You know, this is part of our story. I don't believe it's the full story. We are very much supported by our family, our friends, the people of Killarney Town, our colleagues in An Garda Síochána. I mean, we're a big family. I work in the area of community policing, and I am now the beneficiary of that support, and it's been phenomenal. And I suppose if anything good can come out of the last 4 weeks, the turmoil that we've been through, the unknown, the change, it would be to give back and to highlight this fantastic project and get support for the book that we're both involved in from our work point of view, but now very much from a family point of view. And as I said, a very unknown road ahead of us.
And can I ask you how old you are, Diane?
I'm 37, Ryan. I'll be 38 in July.
Okay. And Tara Grace, as you say, she's 22 months old.
Correct,
and
yeah.
Baby number two is ready to hatch in a
ready,
couple of months'
yeah.
time.
The end of July, please God.
So you have this beautiful fear in your life, the beauty of the impending arrival and the fear of the unknown.
That's it.
So tell me, what are they saying to you about Pádraig and about the future?
It's very unknown. There is great hope. There is great. We have fantastic statistics behind us with Dr. Power. He's an incredible man. It's for the biggest obstacle at the moment is for the immunotherapy to work. If the immunotherapy works, then we're talking odds of 70%. It's revolutionary. It's an incredible treatment that is available to him. And he's only one of 16 people in Ireland who is having or has had this treatment.
And considering the daunting times ahead, Diane is incredibly philosophical.
You know, we did a birthday video for Pádraig on Monday, and we had well wishes from everyone from the Taoiseach to Micheál Mór Shaoirse. The video was 45 minutes long, and if love and support and encouragement could cure Pádraig, he'd be Superman at this stage. And you know, we have to hold on to that and just hope for the very best. I mean, none of us know what any of us are facing. You know, if any of us look too far ahead, the future is very unknown. You know, you can be anxious. So we just have to live in the moment, and we have to take. Sometimes it's every hour by hour. You know, he's had his ups and downs. He's had a very difficult 4 weeks. But we just have to live in the moment and take every day as it comes. I mean, we don't have any time to rush. None of us have, really. And I suppose, as a member of An Garda Síochána, myself and Pádraig have been there when people's lives have changed. We've been the one to change people's lives, unfortunately, when it comes to breaking bad news. And I really think that's given us such great perspective in the last few weeks, and has helped us to face and to deal with what's ahead of us.
Emma is in Limerick, and she texted to say, love to my friend Diane on the show today. Lockdown and fear of COVID when Pádraig is so sick and she's pregnant is so cruel that we can't support and help her in person, but we can't wait to hug her and her bump and Tara Grace and Pádraig. You know, I was being so joyful about the restrictions being lifted this morning that I forgot, of course, that life goes on with all its challenges. So at the same time, it is good news in terms of people like Emma, your friend in Limerick, will soon be able to come and see you, which I hope will offer some strength to you, Diane. Brian Looney in Killarney says, Diane is a brilliant community guard and very well regarded by everyone that she engages with. She treats everybody with courtesy and respect. I wish her and Pádraig well, and hopefully his treatment leads to remission. If somebody wanted to help today, what could they do, or how practical could they be?
Yeah, so Mary Carl, as I said, she's the powerhouse behind this project. You'll find the little memory gallery. It's her photography. She's a freelance photographer on Instagram or on Facebook. So that's the little memory gallery, and there's a link there to support the fundraising efforts. Or equally, if anyone wants to get directly involved and, I don't know, maybe publish the book for us,
okay,
which would be incredible. I mean, it is very specific to Killarney. It is about Killarney people, but it's a snapshot of the last year. It's essentially a time capsule, and it's a real cross-section of society, which I really believe that all of us can identify with someone in the features in the book, whether it be a young person, a frontline worker or our older family members that we haven't been able to see over the last 12, 15 months.
Diane Collins on the Ryan Tubridy Show. Now, from taking the knee to abstaining from social media to highlight an issue, should sports ever be mixed with politics? On Today with Claire Byrne, Owen McDevitt from Second Captains and Sinead O'Carroll from The Journal spoke about the IOC banning protests.
It feels a bit like the Olympic Council have their, or the IOC, I should say, have their head in the sand here and don't appear to have noticed what's been happening in the last couple of years, which is that the athletes have found their voice. I was going to say found their voice again, because there has been athlete activism over the years and over the decades, going back to Muhammad Ali and more. But there really has been a resurgence in the last couple of years. And when the IOC say things like, we don't have political demonstrations at our events, we don't have them on the podium, this kind of thing. I mean, they say that what they really mean by political is, what we're talking about here, I think anyway, is, you know, it's human rights we're talking about. It's humanity. It's not like they like to use the term political because it's almost like as a sports fan, sometimes you recoil at that because you go, yeah, we don't really want politics involved in sport. But really what it is the real world. And the real world and sport, it's all part of the same thing. You know, sport can't exist in a bubble. And in the last couple of years in particular, it hasn't been existing in a bubble. And we see that with what's going on with the social media boycott over the last couple of days. John, I actually think this is going to be a big backlash as we get closer to the Olympics. Already, the US Olympic Committee says it's not going to sanction its athletes if they do protest on the podium. Team GB athletes, there's murmurings from there, from Great Britain, that they might still look at ways of protesting on the podium and, yeah, and at the ceremony. So I'm not sure. I think there will be a backlash. I think the IOC has misread the tea leaves a little bit here.
Well, it would be strange, I suppose, if there wasn't a backlash. Sinead, can you see or can you explain what the IOC is trying to do by saying that these protests can't happen?
It's trying to do the impossible, really, Claire, because trying to separate, like you said there, can politics and sport coexist? How can they not coexist? The mere presence of some people at the Olympics will be seen as political by some people. And like there, as Owen said, there's loads of examples of that. The presence of black people over the years has been seen as political. It's only been recently we've seen women in hijabs at the Olympics, and that is seen as political. The first gay athletes on the American team at the last Winter Olympics was seen as a movement to some people that would have been political. So people's mere presence in sport means that there is fight for human rights, there's fight for equality, and that has always been thus. And actually what the IOC is really wrong about is that they're generally, they're transcendent athletes. They're the people who we know. They're the people who we remember. Jesse Owens, Muhammad Ali, the more recognisable recent ones, Marcus Rashford, Colin Kaepernick, the people who bring themselves into realms that people see as political, but actually it's just them taking the idea of being role models to the next level.
Okay, and we're going to talk about some of those individuals as we go through all of this. But going back, Owen, to the social media ban, the English soccer clubs, it's not just around racial abuse. And I want to talk to you about Aaron Connolly, who's had a difficult time at Brighton. And this was about his on-pitch performance.
Yeah, Aaron Connolly just missed a couple of chances recently and was subjected to some online abuse, the exact details of which we don't know, but it was enough for his coach, Graham Potter, to speak out about it. So that one was nothing to do with race or anything like that. A lot of them are racial. I mean, the amount of black footballers, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Raheem Sterling, you name them. Callum Robinson is another, an Irish international recently, who was abused. And it seems like black footballers now, and there's plenty of female footballers as well have been abused in recent times. It seems like with black footballers, whether they score a goal, do their job correctly as it's seen, or do their job badly, as soon as they're noticed, it seems like they're then a target. They're seen as a legitimate target by some people online for abuse. And what's happening here is that essentially the footballers and the clubs and the leagues, and it's not just like cricket, other sports have actually joined this. They're all coming together to try to get the social media companies to be more proactive. They've tried this now for the last while, but they feel the social media companies aren't essentially doing enough to protect them. And it's kind of hard to disagree with that, John.
Just want to talk to you both about the Super League controversy. It was only last week, wasn't it? But some of the players were very vocal on that. And I just wonder, is that activism Or is that seeing which way the wind was blowing? And maybe for some of them, it was protecting what they have in terms of their salaries, their ability to transfer with high fees and so on. Sinead, where do you place the outrage that was expressed by some of those top players to the notion of the Super League?
I think a lot of it, and more cynical people might think differently, but I do think a lot of it was looking at where they come from themselves, you know, and seeing football as, you know, a game for them as kids, for the kids now, and football clubs as being local entities. So I do think a lot of it was coming from a place of activism that, you know, football clubs should belong to communities, and the Super League really was the antithesis of that. People like Patrick Bamford, who, you know, in his reaction to it, obviously disagreed with it, but also said if the people who held the purse strings cared as much about problems in the game like racism, then we could be moving on these things a lot better. So I do think that there was genuine activism in a lot of the response, not just minding their own sector.
And Owen explains some of the activists in football, like Marcus Rashford.
Well, what he tackled was an issue last year during coronavirus where the school meal vouchers that are given to kids and poverty-stricken kids in the UK, in England specifically, weren't going to go ahead through the summer holidays. So when COVID hit, the vouchers were getting sent out, or meals were getting sent out to the homes, and these kids were still getting fed. These kids who needed this means to get food in their bellies were still getting it, but it wasn't going to happen during the summer holidays until Marcus Rashford got involved. He wrote an open letter to MPs detailing his own experience, which was that he had to use these kind of facilities. His mother worked as hard as she could, but single mum, had five children and struggled to feed them at times. So he detailed that in this open letter. And he had an amazing line. He said, this is not about politics. This is about humanity. Political affiliations aside, could we not all agree that no child should be going to bed hungry? Which obviously really hit home and really cut through a lot of the bull when you hear sporting organisations talking about politics. So, as he says, it was about humanity. And he managed to get, essentially, he managed to pressure Boris Johnson and the government to install that voucher system through the summer.
Across the summer.
And he kept going. He did it again. He kept the pressure going. And since then, he had a petition that had over a million signatures, and the system has been essentially gone through to this year as well during the various holidays, and he's got various other expansions. So he's been phenomenally successful. And I think part of the reason he was so successful was he took on a very specific cause there. You know, it was a really he zeroed in on one specific thing where he thought, rather than just generally saying that we want more equality or we want a better society to live in, he found an area that he thought he could make a difference in, and he felt a personal connection
to. And it could measurably impact and affect.
Exactly.
And you mentioned his own personal experience. Here he is speaking to the BBC last year about what, for him, prompted this campaign.
You know, my mum, she'd done the best she could. I remember we used to go to a shop called Pound World, and everything was under a pound, and you know, we sort of schedule out the week, so we'd get seven yogurts and you can have one yogurt a day and so on. So she done the best she could within the circumstances, but there's some families out there like me that have four or five kids, so it's literally impossible for her to take control of the situation. You know, that this is all going on at a time where kids should be concentrating on schoolwork and stuff like that, and it's just crazy to think that this is still going on at this, you know, we're in 2020 now, and it's just something that I don't believe should be happening.
Marcus Rashford from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, Caroline called Joe about the midterm break.
Joe, I contacted you yesterday evening because I received a text message from my daughter's primary school that the school will be closed next week for the midterm break. And I just was quite frustrated, to be honest. I really don't feel it's appropriate for the Department of Education to endorse and for teachers to take 4 days holidays next week, given that we are in the midst of a global pandemic and the students have lost so much time. They've lost so much time academically, but also socially and developmentally, you know, due to missing out on school. And I really don't feel it's appropriate for teachers to take 4 days off next week.
And when did you first find out?
I got a text message yesterday. Now, in fairness, there is a school calendar in place, which the Department of Education would have set up. But I suppose I hadn't reviewed it. But I did feel there was 3 extra days taken after the Christmas holidays in January. 3 extra days taken then. And then there was two additional days that there was remote learning after the Christmas holidays. So I did feel that there should have been some pragmatism and leadership shown, that they would have, you know, shown some flexibility around the days that the teachers took this year, given what has occurred. And so I'm very disappointed that, you know, in light of the fact that there were three extra days given after Christmas, that the teachers were still going to take 4 days next week.
And how would you manage?
Well, I'm not too bad because I have older children and, you know, so from that perspective. But it's really a concern that I think, you know, you have to question the value that we place on education as a society, because there would be a lot of children that mightn't be, you know, that school is a real place of stability for them. Mm-hmm. And they've also lost hugely on their education, because even though, and I fully acknowledge the teachers' work during the homeschooling period, the hours at school or at home haven't fully compensated for the education in the classroom.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, there's a huge value on children meeting their friends. And, you know, they had a week off in February, and then they had 2 weeks off at the end of March for Easter. And now,
so hang on, I thought you could either take your midterm, so to speak, in February or May, but not both.
Yes, I thought so too, but they did have the week off in February, and
it was the school you're dealing with.
Yes,
you're adamant.
And I mean, yes, I am. And of course, there could be some variation, because I know not all primary schools are off next week, but certainly my one is closed.
But you're saying your one, you understood that they already had a midterm break.
Yes. Now, just to clarify, the May dates are down as being appropriate school holidays. But my belief is that there should be flexibility, given there was extra days taken in January, given the number of days that students have lost out already. I think the teachers really, and it's the Department of Education primarily, should consider, you know, their role and, you know, the importance of supporting the children.
Now, did you, or have you noticed your child slipping back, so to speak?
She has a little, and I mean, that's probably partly because, I suppose, in terms of the homeschooling, I work full time. So, you know, I was doing my best to make up that time. But, and I mean, there'll be a lot of parents in similar position that just didn't have the time to give that extra education to their children. You know, our role, we're not educators. We did our best. But as I said, it's not all about the academics. I think school is such an important environment for their growth in so many ways.
While there is no scheduled midterm break, some schools may decide to use their discretionary days during this period, Caroline. So it's discretionary days. I didn't know they still had them.
Okay.
Was that the sound of silence, the sound of your jaw dropping? It's not a midterm. They're known as discretionary days.
All I'll say, Joe, is that's really disappointing, because, you know, discretion at the moment, I don't think it should be at their discretion to take extra holidays.
So that's next week brings us into May. Then May the 10th is Monday week. Certain things reopening. Then the June bank holiday is the beginning of June, and then the primary schools, the beginning of June is the leaving cert, so that's the second level schools are gone, and then the primary schools are gone, isn't that the end of June? But there was talk, I don't know whether you're following, Carolyn, and I'm not totally up to speed on it, but I remember hearing a few weeks ago in the British media that they were talking about, to try and help primary school students, pupils catch up, bringing them in over the summer.
I'd heard that. I mean, I am taken aback to think that this is a discretion that my school has taken. To be honest, it's quite disappointing, because I do feel, you know, the teachers have had a lot of, I won't say time off, but they haven't had to attend in the same way for the last year and a half. And I think, you know, the students deserve to get as much education as they can before they finish in June.
Well, that's Caroline. Then Noreen called Joe.
I know, I just wanted to say that I do kind of put some support behind that. I do agree with what she's saying.
And have you primary school children?
I have two primary school kids. And just, you know, from talking to a lot of parents,
who have kids of a similar age, of a 12-year-old and just gone 10-year-old, the kids have really, really struggled.
Yeah, okay.
In this lockdown, they've had no voice, I suppose. It's been up to the parents. There's been a lot of disruption for them, from communions cancelled to confirmations, and they just take it in their stride at that age. But it has had an impact on them, and from a lot of parents I've spoken to, you know, lots of kids have developed anxieties where there wouldn't have been any. And it's just the disruption that they've gone through, and you're kind of settling them back into school, and then they were off Paddy's Day, and then you're settling them back again, and then they broke for 2 weeks for Easter, and now you're settling them back again, and again there's further breaks. They all have, my eldest has regressed academically.
Okay.
In terms of how he's doing, he's going to be going into senior school now in September, so you know, there is that worry. We're trying to get him extra grinds at home to make sure that he's up to speed. Look, as Caroline said, academically, 100%, they're behind. But
and what, what age is your
a 12 and a 10-year-old.
And who's getting the grinds?
The 12-year-old.
In what subjects?
Maths and Irish.
Why at that age?
Because he'd regressed quite.
Okay.
You know, quite significantly since COVID hit. You know, they missed quite an amount of school in fifth class, and then also missed a huge amount now this year in sixth class. So it, I think it's, a lot of it is a confidence thing as well. The confidence got knocked, and it had a knock-on effect.
And why? How are grinds conducted during a pandemic?
Well, we do. Literally just a one-on-one, and it's across the table, 2 metres apart.
But does
so they just do it across the table, just kind of trying to learn through on a laptop and that.
Well, that's Noreen there. Then later, Anne called Jo.
Hi, Jo. I was actually ringing in originally about your earlier speakers who were talking, well, basically teaching bashing, and I was
No, hang on. But no cliches now. Teacher bashing is a meaningless phrase. People of this country are allowed to debate issues. And if they raise if parents raise the issue of, especially in the current pandemic, of their children not being in school again next week, they're not going to be dismissed.
I shouldn't have phoned in to try and balance the argument.
Well, balance the argument. Stop using the phrase and dismissing people as teacher bashing.
In fact, I took on board exactly what was being said. My reason for ringing in was every teacher in the country is unable to respond to what was being said then, and that was my motivation for ringing in. But subsequently, I've been listening to the conversation about the Flourish or
I'll go to that in a sec. But what is your response to those parents who say that next week after the lockdown?
Okay, can I just clarify a few of the misconceptions? First of all, the term discretionary days was bandied about
by the Department of Education.
Okay. The discretionary days are part of the school calendar, and primary schools are obliged to teach for 183 days. Mm. When they do their totals, there are 3 or 4 days over and above, and schools can use those at their discretion. Two of the days in February midterm are obligatory. They have to close for just 2 days. They can put 3 days of their discretionary days with those to make a week, or they can use those in May. But I suppose the point that I was trying to make was that I know firsthand how hard school leaders and teachers have been working, and there seems to be a misconception that somehow they were not working when schools were open. And I would be able to speak firsthand about teachers and principals who were working late into the night, doing contact tracing, trying to find substitute teachers, trying to look after their own children and come on a Zoom call and teach and prepare on a professional basis. So I think it would be unfair. Teachers are hugely aware, Joe, of the notion of the break in relationships. Children will catch up academically. I can guarantee you that unless there's an issue, or, you know, academically for them. It is the mental health that is the concern. And one of your speakers said she's not an educator. Well, parents are the primary educators of this. And that was the point that I was bringing in about. Okay.
That's Anne on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on the Ryan Tubridy Show, how many of these can you relate to?
I'm going to give you a quick taste of when you know you're old when. OK, because I came up with my own one, which I'll share with you. It was greeted with an enormous amount of laughter upstairs. And I felt that they were getting a lot of mockery off their chest. You know, it was kind of like, oh, that's funny / yeah, fool. There wasn't joy or mirth in it. It was kind of, there was a nastiness to it, an edge to it. I'll get to that in a minute. But these are signs that you're past it, according to Generation Z, or as they say, probably now because everyone speaks American, Generation Z, you're welcome. So what are the things? Things you do. You order a cappuccino. Apparently, if you order a cappuccino, you're past it. What's wrong with... I don't know. You ask for milk and two sugars in your tea is also you're past it. You wear comfortable shoes. I tried that. Didn't like them. Tried the runners for the walking. No, couldn't do it. You do not recognise any Love Island contestants. Check. You struggle to work your remote control. No, I'm all right now. You plan a second route on a car journey just in case. No. You become obsessed with bin day. Check. You still use a gas barbecue. Too messy. You turn the music down when you park the car. Oh, I do that. What about the arm over the passenger seat when reversing? Is that not... Anyway. You've never posted a video to social media. No. You do not know what a YouTuber is. Ah, come on. You use hashtags incorrectly. No, I'm okay. Not. You're still on Facebook. Never was on it. You worry about not being able to find a parking space a little bit. You ask for your steak well done. No. And finally, you add salt to your food before tasting it, which is, I remember that in school, a teacher once said that the greatest insult to a chef is by putting salt on whatever it is that comes in front of you, because a good chef will have said, I put it exactly what you needed. I don't know what you're adding it to, Barry, because you don't need it. So the one that I got mocked for was that when I'm coming off a walk, whether it's down a hill or off the pier or whatever it might be, about a third of the way to go still, I'll take my car key out, almost pointing it at the car going, I'm ready to go now. And that's probably getting a little bit past it. So that's probably the best I can offer in terms of getting up.
Yeah, same for the Ryan Tubridy Show. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.